Retro Nerd.
Entering the hive of scum and villainy.
I love democracy.
We shall have order!
The Imperial Senate will no longer be of any concern to us.
My allegiance is to the Republic, to democracy!
Rebellions are built on hope.
Your focus determines your reality.
Luke, you're going to find that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view.
Hello, and welcome to Beltway Banthas, a Star Wars podcast live from the hive of scum and villainy in our very own galaxy, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Stephen Kent, and today we're going to be talking about the ever-important thing called democracy and how to save it. Star Wars teaches us a great deal, particularly the prequel trilogy, about how democracies can decline and at a certain point become unrecognizable to the people who most passionately defend it and believe in those ideas. But it's something that can happen in a low-key way, something that you almost don't even recognize. So this is how democracy dies, with thunderous applause. It is sort of made out to be that you're always going to recognize when freedom is being given away and when liberty is dying on the vine. But I believe that we need to be wary of other things that are happening right before our eyes, some things that are harder to see. And this episode is going to parse, are we losing our democracy in ways that don't involve a scary, easy to see, and plain as sight black-robed dictator taking over the reins of democratic government and turning it into something else, an empire, if you will? We're going to talk about that on this episode and in the following roundtable episode, where we'll get more into the weeds as well about the different ways in which democracies can become unrecognizable. And if you're not defending the little things, the little minutiae aspects of your democracy, you can lose it. And I'm excited for you to hear both of those, featuring guest insights from Danielle Adams, Nick DeCalandria, political scientist Seth Maskett, and scholar Ilya Soman. So with that, let's dive into, do democracies always die with thunderous applause? It was on July 30th, 2020, that a sitting U.S. president, for the first time ever, suggested publicly that an upcoming federal election be delayed. Taking to Twitter, as he often does for ill-advised ideas, President Trump tweeted, with universal
mail-in voting, not absentee voting, which is good, 2020
will
be
the most
inaccurate
and fraudulent election in history. It will be a great embarrassment to the USA. Delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote, he asks.
There's a first time for everything, and for Trump's most committed critics, this kind of anti-democratic expression doesn't really come as a surprise. But if there's one thing that Americans on the left and right are pretty well attuned to, I think, it's perhaps even to a fault. It's the specter of dictatorship, handed down to us in standard U.S. history classes all the way from our founding. Of course, if you're anything like me, your real schooling in the demise of democracy came from the Star Wars prequel trilogy. It's how it really became real. You know, the entire idea that the founding fathers all got together and they never wanted to have another King George. It does honestly feel abstract. Palpatine felt real. The first time I ever considered the idea that American democracy could be temporary was in 2005. It was Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith. It had just hit theaters. And the discussion at my school of how Chancellor Palpatine had transformed the Republic into an empire was everywhere on the schoolyard the next day. All my friends were talking about it at lunch for at least the next couple of weeks, and I vividly remember a friend asking during our lunchtime banter about Episode 3, he said, "Do you think Bush will ever try to stay in office?" I was a pretty conservative teenager at the time, but even then I did wonder. I mean, with the controversial Iraq War nearly 2 years in and George W. Bush having just been reelected on a platform of fighting terror at home and abroad, my imagination really was, for the first time, running wild with how America could go the way of the Republic. You kind of have to be blind to have not seen the Star Wars trilogy at that time and at least ask that question. Looking back on that time, it does feel kind of silly in comparison to where things stand today. But the lesson of George Lucas's prequels were to be vigilant, even of a mild-mannered, buttoned-up politician like Sheev Palpatine. For a whole generation of fans, if you were unaware of how Julius Caesar transformed the Roman Republic into a Roman Empire, or that Adolf Hitler was a democratically elected chancellor just 1 year before becoming the Führer of Germany, Star Wars was your lesson on the popularly understood way in which democracies do steadily decline and can eventually become marred dictatorship.
The Republic will be reorganized into the First Galactic Empire for a safe and secure society.
I talked to Professor Seth Maskett, author of Learning from Loss, The Democrats 2016 to 2020, about the causes of democratic decline both here and in a galaxy far, far away.
I think, at least for the American case, I think the Star Wars universe got it a little wrong. You know, and okay, fine, it's a sci-fi film, it's going to treat this a little simplistically, but I think the main thing that they got wrong with this is that they made democratic decline look sudden. You know, Palpatine, he operated in secret for years, but then one day the mask comes off and it turns out, oh no, this leader we've had for a decade is suddenly evil and undemocratic and there's nothing we can do about it. The films didn't really pay attention to sort of like the slow democratic decline, that can occur, when there are repeated violations and, repeated undemocratic outcomes that really don't get addressed by the system. And, you know, there's also the problem that the authoritarian government never calls itself the authoritarian government. you know, no one ever right. rips off their mask and says, oh, it turns out I'm evil. Everyone still thinks they're the hero and they, you know, continue to have the backing of, you know, some healthy portion of the electorate. And make it sound like what they're doing is still consistent with democratic traditions, even when it's not.
Kind of crossing streams of argumentation here. You wrote for Vox once that the Star Wars Galactic Senate needed to survive. The descent into autocracy was in fact a minority party, that there needed to be political parties in the Star Wars Senate to make this not happen. Can you explain that argument and what you wrote back then?
So, yeah, I continue to believe this, that like a minority party in the Galactic Senate would have really helped. And that's one of the things in the few scenes we see of life in the Galactic Senate, we don't see any indication of parties there. And, you know, which is, I think, a pretty staggering omission, for particularly for a legislature of that size, to not have functioning parties. Give an example, there's a deleted scene from Revenge of the Sith. I'm sure you're familiar with it.
And your
loyal fans are, where, you know, that actually shows, you know, some sort of a secret caucus. You've got Padme, you've got Mon Mothma. I think Bail Organa was in the room, essentially meeting in secret to voice their concerns about the ongoing war with the clones, about the Chancellor's growing powers.
Now that he has control of the Jedi Council, the Chancellor has appointed governors to oversee all star systems in the Republic.
When did this happen?
Oh, that decree was posted this morning.
Do you think he'll dismantle the Senate? Why bother?
As a practical matter, the Senate no longer exists.
The Constitution is in shreds.
I saw this and I'm thinking, like, well, what if they had some sort of infrastructure to, like, organize legislative votes to resist some of these moves, to give voice to people's concerns, and also to conduct research? Think of the earlier movie, think of Attack of the Clones, where there was a conspiracy going on in the background, and it didn't take Obi-Wan Kenobi that long to figure it out. Like, he knows, yeah. Oh my God, there's a star system missing from government maps. Like, that's a big thing. And then a few minutes later, he finds that, oh my God, they're funding a secret army on an invisible planet.
They are using a bounty hunter named Jango Fett to create a clone army. I have a strong feeling that this bounty hunter is the assassin we're looking for.
This should have been a huge scandal. Obi-Wan didn't know what to do with it. He wasn't blogging. I don't think he had any reporters available that he knew. So he didn't know what to do about it. And then all of a sudden the war started and no one cares. But that is something a party could have made really good use of that information, and it could have really undermined Palpatine's power if the scandal had come out, and he would have made attempts to stop it or to minimize some of the damage. The fact that you have any critics just sort of meeting in secret meant that they just were not that organized, and you had the basis for a rebellion after.
So I guess what I'm kind of getting at here with these two angles is, are we facing a decline in democratic government because of a concerted effort to govern with a minoritarian strategy, or are we just failing in other ways to make space for compromise and really make this polarized two-party situation work? Because it's not like we haven't done that before in the past.
I tend to feel that the problem is less about compromise than it is about competition. That is, there have been plenty of, fairly healthy democracies where the major parties don't really work together very well. They don't necessarily reach compromises. They can mistrust each other,
right?
But they still have a functioning legislature where you can fight out things, and where a majority party can rule and make decisions. And if people are grossly offended by that, there can be a healthy election the next time around, and maybe the other party wins. But, you can have, pretty intense partisanship and still functional democracy. But when you have a situation where one party can continue to rule, even if, the mass of voters prefers the other party, mm-hmm. that's dangerous. And, that sort of throws the whole idea of accountability out the window. I mean, one of the things you see is that parties, there's been a number of studies, not just in the US, about how party platforms change with time. And, where if a party finds itself tossed out of power and it continues to lose power with time, what you see is that it actually moderates its platform. And it's not necessarily that like people within that party like people in the other party more. They don't necessarily see each other as more human or more deserving. It's just that they want to win elections. So they come up with a more moderate platform. That has been the pattern in the United States for a fair amount of time. If you have a situation where, the governing party determines that it can continue to remain the governing party without moderating, because it has built-in electoral biases, that's really dangerous, and that sort of gets rid of any desire to moderate. And I'm not sure how much to make of it, but the fact that Republicans only won the White House by the skin of their teeth in 2016, they were going into 2020 with their nominee fairly unpopular, trailing in polls. You think they'd have some incentive to moderate their platform. They decided not to write a platform this year. That's telling about something. I don't know exactly what to make of that, but it's sort of not encouraging from a democratic accountability standpoint.
The Republican National Convention is happening this week, but one part seems very much up in the air is what exactly the party is about.
They've made it very clear what the GOP stands for now is Trump. They said, we are not going to attempt to pass a platform. And all our platform is we back Donald Trump.
And just to kind of wrap up here, I mean, which party is it exactly that is failing to moderate? Because my understanding of the Democratic Party is that they have excelled throughout most of the 20th century in reaching a large swath of voters in all sorts of different types of backgrounds. But only in recent years have they started to lose their grip on places like the Dakotas, Montana, West Virginia, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Wisconsin. And they're no longer competitive in many of those markets because of their messaging. And it's not because they are being super inclusive and super moderate.
Yeah, the Democratic pattern is really kind of interesting, and honestly, it's somewhat mixed. So I have a book coming out soon called "Learning from Loss: The Democrats 2016 to 2020." It is essentially about what has happened within the Democratic Party just in the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. Up until 2016, honestly, so fairly recently, Democrats were doing what they had been doing for some time, which is, they sort of recognize that the Electoral College is not really stacked in their favor. They tend to need to moderate somewhat in order to win. But you know, really since that election, and particularly 2018, you've seen a real growth in the progressive left that hasn't really translated so much into like votes for Bernie Sanders, but you do have people like, you know, the Squad, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others who are, you know, much more organized and really becoming a new young voice of the Democratic Party and are pulling the party to the left. And you saw this played out in, you know, the Democratic primary presidential debates over the last year where, you know, you had some very high quality candidates, you know, a lot of senators and governors and people, you know, talking about things like reparations for slavery and Medicare for all and some fairly progressive stances that are have become much more mainstreamed within the Democratic Party. Now, it's telling nonetheless that they ultimately decided to nominate Joe Biden. That, you know, after all these debates and speeches and all these campaign events, a lot of people within the Democratic Party were concerned that they needed to moderate to win the presidency. You know, that basically they needed sort of a pretty mainstream Democrat, an older white guy, as the party's face in order to be competitive. So, you know, that's kind of a big signal that moderation is far from dead on the Democratic side. On the other hand, one of the first things Biden did after becoming, you know, the de facto nominee in the party was to work with the Sanders campaign on, you know, a set of governing principles and campaigning principles that were, you know, pretty substantially to the left of where the party had been previously. And, you know, you see that in sort of where the party's platform is and the issues that that the Democrats have been campaigning on. So it's definitely not a uniform movement, but yes, after a long period of relative moderation, you know, there is some evidence that that party is moving leftward.
What I feel like you just described there was the look of a party actually engaging in politics.
Yes, it's weird. They still function like they're a coalition, and that the, you know, coalitions need to be maintained, and you know, people reach compromises and everyone is sort of grumbly because, you know, no one gets 100% of what they want, but that's kind of healthy party politics right there.
I also spoke with Ilya Salman, a law professor at George Mason University and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, about the fall of the Republic and whether the Palpatine outcome, as we're calling it, should be the core of our greatest fear in American politics.
I think it's certainly up there as a possibility in that not only democracy, but also liberalism generally tend to be most at risk during emergencies. I would add, and this is only partially true in the Star Wars universe, that they can also be more at risk when there's deep polarization and antagonism between the different sides of the political spectrum, which you see to some extent, at least in the Clone Wars series and Star Wars, with the hostility between the Separatists and the Republic, but which you see, of course, much more in current American politics and also perhaps in some countries in Europe, because when there is that antagonism, there's much more of a fear of the opposing party coming to power and much more willingness, potentially at least, to take drastic measures to prevent it from happening.
Absolutely. So you mentioned voter ignorance, and you've made the case in the past that the problem with democracy tends to be less in the design of a given government, but in the wits of the people, you know, the voters. It's not a very popular argument to make, but I take your point, and I think it's important. Are we the problem and the threat to democracy? This is alluded to in portions of your review of Rogue One. Could you unpack that dynamic a bit?
Sure. So I do think it's not just the voters, it's also the interaction between them and institutions. And in my book, Democracy and Political Ignorance, I discuss ways in which institutions can be modified and improved so as to reduce the dangers of voter ignorance. But it is also true that voter ignorance is built deep into the structure of democracy in the following way, that in all but the very smallest democratic elections, say perhaps a New England town meeting or something like that, the chance that any one vote will make a difference is extremely small. In a presidential election, it may be about 1 in 60 million or so, depending on what state you live in. And so if your only reason to be a well-informed voter is to make sure you cast a better ballot when it comes time to go to the polls, or this year perhaps vote by mail, that's not much of an incentive at all, because the chance that your knowledge will make a difference is so small. So most people, they obviously don't know the exact odds that their vote will make a difference, but they intuit that there's not much payoff to spending a lot of time and effort learning about politics. And as a result, we have an electorate that first, in most cases, knows very little about the issues at stake, and second, often does a poor job of evaluating the information that they do know. We know that most people evaluate political information in a highly biased way, that's very partisan, and that tends to ignore or downplay any evidence that goes against their pre-existing views, while overhyping and overvaluing any evidence that supports them. And so we both have voters that tend to be ignorant, and voters that tend to do a bad job of evaluating what they do know. And that's not because the voters are generally stupid or incapable of acquiring even basic political knowledge. It's because of the incentives that are built into the system, where there's so little payoff or so little incentive for the individual voter to actually be well-informed or to take an unbiased view of the issues at stake.
Just to round us down here, you've mentioned that Star Wars offers a somewhat bleak picture of democracy and its effectiveness. I think that that is well encapsulated in the prequels, and just the fact that George Lucas sort of ascribed senators to like the bumper sticker special interest approach, you know, including the Trade Federation, the banking clan, and the likes, into actually being represented by the Senate body, making a commentary about special interests and their stranglehold on democracy. That's one way in which, you know, you look at the Republic and you go, okay, well, I mean, it's not like this was exactly the system that we want. So Star Wars, in the end, you're like, all right, so I don't like the Empire, but what is the case for the Republic? In your mind, what is the way in which Star Wars sort of fails to make an affirmative case for democracy as inherently good rather than just obviously good because the Empire is bad?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there are two ways in which Star Wars fails to do this. One is, almost any time you see a democratic institution at work, such as the Senate, for example, but also even when we see the internal politics of the rebellion in Rogue One, and in the most recent cycle of three movies, and we see the New Republic at work, almost always that institution is dysfunctional, and it makes stupid mistakes, and moreover, it's very prone to voter ignorance. Obviously, Palpatine fooled them into believing that a real crisis exists, when in reality it's one that he's cooked up, and he continues to successfully fool them, both the voters and also many of the political elites. He fools them successfully until he manages to make himself emperor, and then later in the most recent trilogy, the new Sith force manages to build up a massive fleet and a massive empire right under the nose of the New Republic, and again, they don't notice until it's too late what's actually going on. So the democratic institutions don't look very good in the series. And when you look at the quote-unquote good guys, the rebels in the original series, or the resistance in the more recent one, it's not at all clear what exactly they're fighting for as opposed to fighting against. They don't talk much about what sorts of institutions they want to set up. If they want something different from the previous Republic, which failed so spectacularly, nobody seemed to explain different in what way. So there is this sense that to the extent that the rebels are good, it's not because they're pro-democratic or would set up better institutions. It's because they have better and nicer people leading them, like Princess Leia or Luke Skywalker and others. So the sense is that, and I'm not sure this is fully intended by the producers, but the sense is that what's really important is that nice people be in power, as opposed to whether it's democratic or not. And I would note that George Lucas himself famously said that the best form of government is a benevolent despotism. I'm not sure that vision is shared by Disney, which took over the production of the series and which also produced the Clone Wars prequel, which I think is more nuanced in its treatment of democracy. But even there, democratic institutions tend not to look very good and the Senate functioned very poorly.
We need a system where the politicians sit down and discuss the problem, agree what's in the best interest of all the people, and then do it.
That's exactly what we do. The trouble is that people don't always agree.
Well, then they should be made to.
By whom? Who's going to make them?
I don't know. Someone.
You?
Of course not me.
But someone.
Someone wise.
Sounds an awful lot like a dictatorship to me.
Well, if it works.
Star Wars was your lesson on the popularly understood way in which democracies do steadily decline and can eventually become marred in dictatorship. So this is how liberty dies. With thunderous applause. It's arguably Padme's most impactful piece of dialogue in Revenge of the Sith. The evidence is simply that you can't escape it on social media. The GIF is used in excess every election night as the results come in, whatever they may be. Any time that Congress is taking up anything major or minor, people of whatever political stripe who happen to be Star Wars fans are just littering the internet with that wonderful quote. The meaning is simple. Freedom is not taken, but given away, and most often with public approval. Palpatine enjoyed this public support in Episode 2, Attack of the Clones, when he first was granted emergency powers by the Senate to build a clone army in the Republic's defense. Now, his accumulation of power through rushed votes and unilateral decrees, it is referenced in a crucial deleted scene from Revenge of the Sith. What Mon Mothma astutely references in this secret meeting of what would later become the Rebel Alliance as we understand it, is that senators were all too willing to rubber stamp Chancellor Palpatine's accumulation of executive power. Just go along with it.
The Chancellor has played the Senate as well. They know where the power lies and they will do whatever it takes to share in it.
And we cannot continue debating about this any longer. We have decided to do what we can to stop it. Senator Mon Mothma and I are putting together an organization.
Say no more, Senator, I understand. At this point, some things are better left unsaid.
They did this according to Mothma because they know where the power lies, and they will do whatever it takes to share in it. Basically, to challenge the overpowered executive would be to embrace political death. Staying close to Palpatine is a devil's bargain, which we know, of course, doesn't work out in their favor. In any way, the problem that Americans face is far more insidious than the simple grabbing of executive power during manufactured crisis situations. One critique of President Trump is that he has all the personality and the desires of a thuggish autocrat. It's kind of right in front of all of us, but none of the Palpatine-esque skill in government to make even his most anti-democratic fever dreams or tweets come true. Watching Trump for 3 years, this really does check out. His bluster is pretty darn vile, but at the end of the day, most of it just amounts to bluster. He can't delay the election. He can't even dismantle the New York Times. These things are not that easy. President Trump represents the tip of a spear for modern Republican strategy of controlling as much of the state and federal government as possible with as few voters as possible. With a mixture of aggressive statehouse gerrymandering, judicial appointments, and a U.S. Senate strategy aimed primarily at winning Supreme Court confirmations, we're mired in a minority rule situation. Put more simply, nothing in American government can get done. It's a uniquely American problem in that resisting popular sentiment, or lowercase d democracy, it's part of our system's design. There is a popular anecdote, it's largely considered to be fictitious by experts, that involves George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, where the former supposedly likened the U.S. Senate, that they were conceptualizing, to be a cooling saucer. The principle being that the Senate would be a more deliberative body and serve to temper the passions of the House, where popular sentiment of the citizenry would be more actively embodied. This slows down change in American life, no doubt. It's exactly the kind of design that cuts against "So This Is How Liberty Dies" with thunderous applause. Y'all, there's never going to be thunderous applause, at least not for the foreseeable future. And then enters the president in most of these cases where gridlock has taken over to govern by the way of executive orders. You can't get any kind of popular consensus in American government right now. And that's where the president does step in. Barack Obama had said in 2014, if Congress remained deadlocked on its legislative goal, that he had a pen and he had a phone, to go the route of executive orders instead. In early August, President Trump channeled the very same energy on renewing coronavirus relief. You know, in theory, a noble goal, after Congress failed to negotiate a second package before going on recess. It's not entirely in the realm of fantasy that a despot could emerge in American politics and seize total control away from Congress and the courts. It's not a total fantasy. We've got to always be wary of Star Wars Central Warning, which is about popular demand for freedom to be exchanged for immediate action in the name of safety, security, insert your issue of choice. Could be terrorism, it could be coronavirus relief. But we've got to stay aware and not blind to the fact that democracy can also die, not just from thunderous applause, but muffled, screaming into a pillow. Well, that was it. A new episode of Beltway Banthas, an entirely new look, a new sound, a new groove, and I really hope that you enjoyed it. There was a lot of thought and hard work and planning really going into this entirely new revamp of the Beltway Banthas podcast, which so many of you have been on this journey with us now since 2016, when Hillary Clinton faced off with Donald Trump, and all of you out there needed a break. You needed some other way to process all of what was going on. Just a really wild set of primaries and a general election. And Beltway Banthas was there for so many people when it was originally Tirso and myself as hosts. And now, I guess, just me standing in the 2020 election cycle, still trying to offer something of the same kind of relief and not escape. Escape has never been the goal here. I guess we don't believe in escapist fandom at Beltway Banthas, but a new way to process all of what you're seeing in the news and in the world around you, and use Star Wars to do it, because Star Wars brings us joy, and Star Wars gives us peace and solace and something of a way to meditate on the things that are playing out right before our eyes. So with that, it brings us to the close. We're going to be doing this every single month. It's going to be monthly-based episodes, kind of now getting into a new rhythm with the release of this one. And we will have bonus content in between those main episodes. These are going to be more highly produced, and they're going to be more narrative. They're going to flow much differently. They're going to be 30 to 45 minutes, and they're going to be like packaged kind of shows. But we still want to have regular roundtable discussion be part of Beltway Banthas, which is why this episode has a companion piece of audio, which is going to be a roundtable discussion on democracies, how they fall apart, what we're concerned about with this year's election, and what you can learn from Star Wars, with old friends of the show, Danielle Adams and Nick DeCalandria, both coincidentally of the Raleigh, North Carolina area, and very much involved in Democratic politics and progressive organizing causes down there. Good friends of mine, big Star Wars fans, and you should all be familiar with them from past episodes, which I will also tease in the show notes and a little bit on social media, just so you can remember who those individuals are. And there's going to be a roundtable episode that comes out here in the first week after you're listening to this, and that's going to be part of what we're going to do with every single episode, so that you kind of get a sense of what to expect, which, if you want to listen to a quick snippet of it, here's a little of what to expect with that roundtable.
So I think that's just the tension, right? It's both and. It's not either or for me. And that's the pull. Because I am defending something that I also fundamentally believe is not for me. And I will defend it with my last breath.
It's because you think the alternative is worse.
Right. Like, I fight for the potential of our democracy, of what I believe our democracy could be, but has yet to fulfill. And I think that's sort of also like when you move forward in the Star Wars universe, it's like, What are they fighting for? They're fighting for the potential of the galaxy to be a source of balance and peace for everyone. And I think, and not everyone's favorite movie, you know, Rose talks about that a little bit. When it looks, you know, and it's like, it looks beautiful on the outside, but look at those who are left behind. So, I think that's the greatest thing, you know, that we're not fighting against the things we hate, but for what we love. And for me, like, the idea of where our democracy could be, is worth fighting for.
I don't know about you, but I am excited just listening back to that right now. It's always a great pleasure to talk to people on this show and really create a space for discussion, because this new format, while it's going to be a little bit more driven by a grand narrative, if you will, I want to make sure that Beltway Banthas is still true to offering different perspectives, not just the guest experts that we have in the main part of the show, but also people who are out there connected to fandom and also change makers in the real world, like Danielle and Nick. So thank you for staying with us. This has been Beltway Banthas. We would like to know what you would like to hear from the show in future monthly episodes. We have a couple of things in mind, but to be honest, we're not set to any one thing right now. So please tell us what you would like to hear more about and get more of these sort of packaged episodes on. You can email us at beltwaybanthas@gmail.com. And you can tweet us at Beltway Banthas. This episode was written and produced by yours truly, Stephen Kent. You can follow me at Stephen_Kent89. That's Stephen with a PH _Kent89. And the episode was produced and edited by Riley Blanton. You can find him on Twitter at The Riley Guy and at Star Wars Report. He is the host of the Star Wars Report podcast and Mouse and Castle, a Disney podcast. And that's a wrap. If you would throw us a subscribe and put us back in your podcast feeds, we would love to be there. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on podchaser.com, a wonderful source for finding, organizing, and sorting podcasts and following some of your favorite personalities as well as podcasters. Really, really great tool. We love podchaser.com. Y'all, I gotta say, it's really nice to be back with you, speaking to you, and I really hope to hear from you and converse with you in our email inbox and on Twitter. Take care of yourself out there, take care of others, and may the Force be with you always.